my god. Oh my god.
I got myself there. I'm so
sorry. Oh my god.
Welcome to the Backasswards podcast. We are the Backasswards boys. I'm Kyle. I use he, they pronouns. And joining me from our amazing, wonderful, beautiful Colorado studio is Arden.
And I use he, him pronouns.
Tonight, guys, gals, and envy pals, Arden and I, both of us,
yes.
Are going to be taking a break from JFK for a week. My brain was gonna explode. because JFK. And also, it's just our yearly tradition to every New Year's, we are gonna talk about some end of the world theories.
Yes.
So we're bringing back another series for you guys.
I am so excited to do end of the world theories again. We did it in 2021 and now we're bringing it back in 2023. And I loved our first end of the world theories episode. And that one was cool because that one actually happened on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
This year it's happening on the 30th, but it's still applicable because the world could end in a couple days from now, folks. You never know. It could
you
be.
Do.
2024.
Someone's always saying the world's about to end. You know?
It's true. It's like what we said last time. We'll never run out of end of the world theories to talk about. And so instead of like trying to put all of them into one episode, we talk about a couple every single year, little bit more in depth.
Yeah. And so last year we talked about the 2012 apocalypse phenomena, and we also talked about what would happen if the Earth fell into a black hole, right? Those were kind of our two topics. This year, we're more talking about two times that people thought the world was going to end. So I'll be talking about the time that Halley's Comet passed the Earth in 1910. And Arden is going to be telling us about the Y2K bug and phenomenon.
And I'm so excited. It's going to be so cool. I am very excited. Very, very excited.
But before we get into it, guys, a little content warning because there is some slightly more heavy topics tonight. Tonight's episode is going to get into some topics that may be sensitive for some of our listeners. Talking about the end of the world means talking about the end of the world. And that can be a hard topic to deal with on its own if you're not careful. Also, one of the stories that we will discuss tonight does have mentions of self-harm. We care about our audience, and we want to make sure that you folks are as safe as possible while listening. So if tonight's episode doesn't work for you, we'll see you next week.
And this is your reminder to always take care of yourselves when consuming media. If you don't know what you're getting into, you might not know how you feel coming out the end of an hour-long podcast. So take care of yourselves, and we'll see you next time.
And as always, guys, before we get into it, we are going to list our sources for this week. And as always, first stop on the research train is our good friend, Wikipedia.
Because we stan Wikipedia on this motherfucking podcast.
If you find yourself in the financial situation to do so, go ahead and throw them a few bucks. I'm sure they could use it.
Yes, it is a very good light bulb and lampshade deed.
Ooh, there we go.
Hey.
I believe it is also a philanthropic deed, though.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
So I used their page on Halley's Comet. I also used an article from Wired.com called Fantastically Wrong, That Time People Thought a Comet Would Gas Us All to Death. And I used an article from Insider.com titled Seven Times People Thought the World Was Going to End.
And I used Wikipedia's page on the year 2000 problem. I also used a article from ADL.org entitled Y2K and the Apocalypse. And I also used an article from NationalGeographic.com titled The Y2K Bug.
But obviously, you guys, despite listing our sources, we are not scholars.
Nope.
And we are probably going to get some things wrong.
Absolutely. I was a baby when Y2K happened, so I might not get everything right.
We are also not linguists, and we are probably going to say some things wrong. Like Halley's Comet.
Haley's
Who
comment.
Who fucking knows? It's somebody's comment.
It is somebody's comment. And so, yeah.
Now, hold on to your asses. Because things are about to get backwards.
It's the second time that we're doing end of the world theories. It's the end of the year, which means that it could be the end of the world. I'm so excited. Kyle's going to go first. I'm going to go second. I hope you folks are ready. Take us into it, Kyle.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I had to do it at some point in the episode. I'm so sorry.
Of course. Of course. Another tradition, obviously.
Hallie's comment. Comet Halley, or sometimes simply Halley, officially designated as 1P/Halley, is a short period comet visible from Earth every 75 to 79 years. Halley is the only known short period comet that is regularly visible to the naked eye from Earth, and thus is the only naked eye comet that can appear twice in a human lifetime.
Wow.
Halley's periodic returns to the inner solar system have been observed and recorded by astronomers around the world since at least 240 BC, but as early as like 460 BC.
Wow. So this comet's been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
Oh, and it's been passing since even long before that, right?
And we've been seeing it.
And being like, oh, shit. This is a big thing because it sticks around for a minute. Like it's yeah. a big deal when Halley's comet comes by. There have been time periods that it has been visible to the naked eye at night for as long as a month, right?
Wow. So the people in the BC times weren't necessarily being like, this is the same comet, but there's something there saying that they saw Halley's comet at some mm-hmm. point, probably, most likely.
Yeah, and we're judging by, you know, about when these accounts were taken and all of this, they're assuming that this was Halley's comet, right?
Right.
It was not until 1705 that the English astronomer Edmund Halley understood that these appearances were reappearances of the same comet. And as a result of the discovery, the comet is thusly named after Halley.
My man Halley. Figured out that it was the same one over and over. So they named the comet after him. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And again, going back through historical records, the first certain appearance of Halley's comet in the historical record is a description from 240 BC in the Chinese chronicle Records of the Grand Historian, or Shiji, which describes a comet that appeared in the east and moved north. The 347 AD and 607 AD approaches each came within 0.09 astronomical units of Earth, giving us a close shave.
Yeah.
That's still, you know, a few hundred thousand miles, don't get me wrong. But,
right.
You know, in terms of space, that is so close.
That's very, very close.
It's uncomfortably close.
Yeah.
The 451 AD apparition was said to herald the defeat of Attila the Hun at the Battle of Chalon.
Adding a bit of a mystical vibe to this.
Not the first time, for sure, but it yeah. has very often been seen as a herald of change, of big historical events, of death. In 1066, the comet was seen in England and was thought to be an omen. And later that year, Harold II of England died at the Battle of Hastings, and William the Conqueror claimed the throne. This was a very big moment in the history of England.
Right.
The comet is represented on the Bayreuth tapestry and is described in the Titulae as a star.
Hmm.
Surviving accounts from the period describe it as appearing to be four times the size of Venus and shining with a light equal to one quarter that of the moon.
Four times the size of Venus, that's four times the size of us?
Mm-hmm.
That, okay, yeah, 0.09 astronomical units is a little bit scarier now. Mm. I thought this was a little guy.
Oh, just like in the night sky, it appeared four times the size of Venus. Yeah, not in like actual size.
Huh. Oh God. See, because then
we would be dead.
Because I was about to be so down with this end of the world theory. I was going to be like, this is how it's going to happen. This is the answer. That's how it'll happen.
No, that's Nibiru.
Oh, yeah, that's shout right. Out. You're right. Shout out Nibiru.
But maybe Halley's most famous appearance would be that of 1910. According to some superstitious folk, on May 6th of 1910, Halley's Comet approached the Earth and killed England's King Edward VII.
What?
Yes.
How? What do you mean?
Well, no one could say definitely how it did, but it did, for sure. It absolutely did. And that was not its only offense. Okay. The Brits also figured that it was an omen of a coming invasion by the Germans. And the French reckoned that it was responsible for the flooding of the Seine. Seine? The flooding of the Seine. Seine? Is that it? Seine? Sorry, we're not linguists. Oops. No,
Excellent.
And yet there was even more apocalyptic hype surrounding the 1910 returning of Halley's Comet, which was named for the astronomer. Writing to the Royal Observatory, one Worrywart warned that the comet would, quote,
cause the Pacific to change basins with the Atlantic, and the primeval forests of North and South America to be swept by the briny avalanche over the sandy plains of the Great Sahara, tumbling over and over with houses, ships, sharks, whales, and all sorts of living things in one heterogeneous mass of chaotic confusion. That guy does sound really worried, I would say.
He was very worried.
He was freaking out about this.
The ocean's just migrating over land and swapping places.
There are whales all around us, folks. You ever thought about it like that? You ever thought about what you would do if whales suddenly appeared next to you? Think about it.
Think about it.
Think about it.
Throughout history, there has always been a bit of panic when comets approach the sun, burning off into long, ominous tails, like we talked about before.
Right.
But in the months preceding Halley's flyby of Earth on May 19th, 1910, folks got real creative with their anxiety. And it didn't help that a few months earlier, the New York Times had announced that one astronomer theorized that the comet would unceremoniously end life as we knew it.
So we've established that this comet is returning every 76 years. And
about, yeah.
So people are guesstimating that it's going to arrive around this time. And this is where people are starting to freak out about this because they think that something could go wrong with this, is what I'm gathering.
There was just extra comet anxiety around this one in particular. That might in part be to do with, you know, the state of the world at the time. We were gearing up for, you know, World War I, and shit was tense already. So,
right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And this author for the New York Times was a Frenchman named Camille Flammarion. And, in typical French despair, he reckoned that as we passed through the comet's tail, cyanogen gas would impregnate the atmosphere and possibly snuff out all life on the planet.
What?
Astronomers had detected that cyanogen gas in the tail using spectroscopy, which reveals an object's composition by analyzing the light coming off of it. And cyanogen is a very deadly poison, which is a grain of potassium salt touched to the tongue being sufficient to cause instant death. So it is a real thing. And right. Some comets do have it, right? This cyanogen gas. And literally like a grain of salt sized dose of it would be enough to be fatal.
Instantly. Instant death. You would die immediately.
Yes. To its credit, though, the New York Times did note that most astronomers did not agree with Flammarion. However, people love drama.
Oh, yeah. Especially when it's the end of the world. If it involves the end of the world, there is drama.
Mm-hmm. One skeptic of this story was Percival Lowell, who noted that the gas was so rarefied as to be thinner than any vacuum, and therefore posed no threat. Basically saying that it's so rare, even if it was in the atmosphere, any dose that you would receive would be insignificant, right?
Because it's so far away or something like that.
Exactly. It's out in the in the vacuum of space. You're fine.
Yeah.
Also stepping in was Robert Ball, director of the Cambridge Observatory, who noted that another famed astronomer, John Herschel, reckoned the whole comet could be squeezed in a portmanteau, which was another word for a suitcase at the time. But the comet is actually 9 miles long, so he was absolutely wrong about that.
Right.
The New York Times hit him back with a very short piece saying, quote,
"If Sir John Herschel really said this comet could be packed in a suitcase, he was talking nonsense. The proposition suggests three factors: the comet, the suitcase, and the packer. The comet will soon be visible, and there are plenty of suitcases, but who will undertake the packing? We do not believe that comet could be packed into a suitcase. Experience teaches that mighty little can be packed in a suitcase by any man. It takes a woman to pack one properly. There are plenty of women, of course, but Sir John's light-hearted assertion, now gaily stepfathered by Sir Robert, will not tempt them to do any unnecessary packing. A comet, once packed in a suitcase or even in a trunk of the largest size, would be must beyond recognition and of no further use to anybody. Better leave the comet where it is. We shall all feel safer."
Don't worry, you were not having a stroke listening to that. Arden read it perfectly. It's a weird-ass quote. I left it in because it's a weird-ass quote.
Yeah.
We literally just get so off topic. It's insane.
We really do.
And yet people were taking this so seriously.
Maybe I should have put a voice on that so that you all can't, cancel me for hating women.
Nobody clipped that. Others also adopted a jovial outlook for the comet's approach. Ian Ridpath wrote in A Comet Called Halley that tunesmiths composed songs to serenade the heavenly visitor, and poets burst into verse. Products such as Bird's Custard and Pear's Soap featured the comet's advertising. "Pear's Soap is visible day and night all over the world," was one slogan.
Wow. They were getting marketing material from this glorious natural phenomena that people have been seeing since before Christ. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
What a long time ago.
Yeah, if Supreme was around at the time, they absolutely would have been doing a comet drop, you know.
I wonder when, I guess
comet
we'll have to wait.
Fenty, you know.
For real, we'll have to wait a couple decades for them to do that, you know.
Yeah, it's coming up in our lifetime.
It's coming up.
But other enterprising capitalists had hatched some slightly more nefarious schemes.
Oh, did they?
Fraudsters? Oh, yeah, not capitalists with a nefarious scheme. Never.
Is that what happened? I've never heard of this before.
Fraudsters hawked anti-comet pills, with one brand proclaiming to be an elixir for escaping the wrath of the heavens.
Dude, I mean, has anybody else watched the Doctor Who special? They basically talked about this in the Doctor Who special, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they basically talked about this in the third Doctor Who special. That's crazy.
That's so funny. other reports of a doctor in Haiti who reported that he was selling the pills as fast as he could make them.
Wow. People were really jumping on the panic aspect of this and trying to capitalize on people's fear, for lack of a better phrase.
Something we might see again in Arden's story, and I don't think we planned that at all, which is great.
Hey, sometimes it just happens like that, folks. This is why we co-host the show together.
I love that. That's so funny. Two Texan charlatans were arrested for marketing sugar pills as the cure-all for all things Comet. But police released them when the customers themselves demanded their freedom.
Bro, oh my God. He sells you sugar pills to protect you from the Comet, and they're a lie. And then he gets arrested for lying to you, and you're like, let him go, please. He saved my life from this Comet.
Literally, yes.
Wow. Crazy.
Gas masks, much like toilet paper in 2020, also flew off the shelves.
Yeah. Wow.
It's little wonder, then, that some people were getting a bit riled up. Ridpath, in his book, wrote, quote,
a shepherd in Washington state was reported to have gone insane with worry about the Comet. While in California, a prospector nailed his feet and one hand to a cross and, despite his agony, pleaded with rescuers to let him remain there. Damn. So people were freaking the fuck out, dude. They were really, were taking this hard.
People were going B-A-N-A-N-A-S. It was crazy.
That's so, that's always the thing with the end of the world theories episodes. It's just like people get so scared, and that's so scary to think about.
And what happens when people get scared, Arden?
People
go to church.
Yeah.
Churches found themselves packed to the brim with worried followers. While at home, people were going so far as to plug their keyholes to keep out the comet's vapors.
Damn. Imagine those water jug conversations, you know what I mean? What are you doing at home to keep yourself safe from the comet gas, brother?
Oh, you gotta get... Fuck, I can't find any gas masks still, dude. Nope.
I went to the Lowe's the other day. They're all out of caulk. I can't seal all the openings to my house. Oh, my God.
But my cousin's bringing me some Haitian anti-comet pills. They're supposed to be absolute gas, so...
The doctor makes them as fast as he possibly can, and then he sends them to us. Wow.
But most rational people saw the comet for what it really was, a actually genuinely spectacular event that most people get to see once in a lifetime. As the Earth passed through the comet's tail on May 19th, 1910, curious onlookers packed the rooftops around the world. The French, other than Flamillon, presumably, enjoyed special comet dinners.
Ooh.
But Flamillon seemed to stick to his theory right until the end of the comet's show, claiming that four observers with him, quote,
had certain olfactory experiences, which are described variously as a smell of burning vegetables, or a marsh, or acetylene.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Realizing that they had survived a near apocalypse, people in France danced and embraced in the streets. But the folks in Atlanta, Georgia, missed out on all of the fun on account of pesky cloud cover.
No! That's so
but
sad.
But the Atlanta Constitution seemed relieved at the very least, declaring that the clouds had in fact saved the city from destruction.
Right.
Atlanta and the rest of the Earth were saved by reality, though.
Right.
For thousands of years of human civilization, comets have come and gone, and we are still here.
Yes.
Weirdly, though, 2 years after the event came an even more fanciful theory from, and I am going to butcher this name, I'm so sorry, Sui Zuxiang Xinling of the Imperial Polytechnic College in Shanghai, China. And they said, quote,
it is obvious the comet has no tail at all. And the so-called tail must be the sun rays, which, while passing through the body of the comet, looks like a tail.
Should the comet itself be transparent, it could form a convex lens. And then everything on Earth would be burnt like an ant in a sun, in a magnifying glass in the sun.
Right.
Provided that the sunlight passed through the body of the comet and focused all of the falls right on Earth, you know? As long as that happened, and if it was hypothetically clear.
And was able to do that in this specific circumstance. Oh my God.
Halley's Comet made another slightly less panic-inducing return in 1986. And a kind of cool fact, actually, the comet reached its slowest and farthest point in orbit as of recording yesterday on the 9th of December. Nice. And so it is now officially on its way back to Earth. And it will make its return on July 28th of 2061.
Hell yeah. We got to check it out. We got to see that.
Oh yeah. Keep your ear tuned for that live broadcast in a few years from us.
We're not that far away from that year either. Not as far as you would think we are.
Got 38
years or something like that.
Yeah.
Incredible.
We'll be old, but you know.
We'll be a little old. We won't be that old.
Yeah. We'll still have some prime years left.
Well, we'll still have the brain cells to know what the hell is going on.
Yeah. Plus, you know, like, we survived Y2K, so we will be fine.
You know, it's actually great that you bring this up, Kyle. Because,
oh, really?
Because, folks, it is now time for us to talk about Y2K. We will definitely have a back-assward stance at the end of this episode for what we just talked about. But we are going to transition into Y2K now.
Take the reins, Arden.
Phenomenal work, by the way, Kyle. So, the Y2K bug was a computer flaw or bug that may have caused problems when dealing with dates beyond December 31st, 1999. And for those of you who are wondering, this is going to make sense a little bit really, really soon. But I feel like the only thing that I want to say to you folks right now is that a lot of this revolves around technology. This is a very technology-induced paranoia and phenomena. And so with that, this Y2K bug or flaw was faced by computer programmers and users all over the world, particularly on January 1st of the year 2000. This was also known as the Millennium Bug, and many skeptics believe that this was barely a problem at all. And just like Kyle, and kind of like me a little bit, but we're going to get to that. We got to build to that, right? Very quickly, for those of you who do not know or who are not familiar with this, the acronym Y2K, we're going to break it up so that we can understand it, right? The Y stands for year, the 2 references the number 2, and the K stands helo, which is a unit of 1,000, and is commonly used to represent the number 1,000. So Y2K stands for the year 2000, right? For those of you who play NBA 2K, you already understand this concept. So as the year 2000 approached, computer programmers realized that computers might not be able to interpret 00, the number sequence 00, as the year 2000, but instead as the year 1900, right?
Because computers were new and most computers used a two-digit year input.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. And so activities that were programmed on a daily or a yearly basis would be damaged and flawed. That was the hypothesis surrounding this, right? As December 31st, 1999 turned into January 1st, 2000, they might interpret December 31st, 1999 turning into January 1st of 1900, which would present a couple of problems, right?
Potentially, yeah.
If the operating system all around us immediately thought that it was like 100 years ago instead of tomorrow, you know what I mean? Particularly now, more so than in 1999, but...
Did no one just think to, like, update their computer's clock?
I think...
And, like move it ahead and see what would happen? Like, why do we need to theorize about it?
Well, and we're going to talk about the implications of this a little bit more, because, like, yes, very much to what you're saying, Kyle, like, maybe turning my computer to the year 2001 or potentially 1901 wouldn't have done anything. But if the stock market just decided to do that, it would fuck up like that whole month, that whole week, that whole year. You know what I mean? And so we could have like maybe test theoried it on smaller applications, but in reference to like the large things that it relied on, or the large things that relied on it. Yeah. Yeah,
that's fair.
So well before the computer era, years were handwritten in full without abbreviation or an apostrophe. An example would be, quote,
in the year of our Lord, 1917.
Exactly, Kyle. Exactly like that, in that voice every time. That's how it was, right? Yeah. That's how people would write years. They wrote out every single character. After 1931, it became increasingly common to abbreviate the four-year digit with a two-digit contraction, including an apostrophe, such as 42 for the year 1942. Right. Because after 1931, it was impossible to mistake a two-digit year for a day of the month. Right?
That's fair, I guess.
And this was the very beginning of the Y2K problem. With this practice continued into the next century, two-digit year formats could easily be mistaken for a day or month for the first 31 years of a century. Because, you see, at the beginning of computing, at the dawn of computing, data was stored by punching physical holes into 3x7-inch paper cards, stacks of which were fed into machines to do individual calculations, right? One thing at a time. You can't run your Discord and your Spotify at the same time on these computers, okay, kids? You understand what I'm saying to you?
You're not playing Fortnite on this computer.
Exactly. Memory was so expensive and took up so much space that multiple rooms, physical rooms, would have to be dedicated for early computers to store memory. Early core memory cost $1 per bit, which is $9.10 today, adjusted for inflation. Popular commercial computers, such as the IBM 1401, shipped with as little as 2 kilobytes of memory in total.
That's nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing. This is a very small amount. Thus, as the result of this, the information recorded was kept to the bare minimum. This is part of the reason why we use the two-digit abbreviation, is because it just took up less memory on the computers. It was easier to program the computers and do what we needed to do with them and punch less holes in those cards to get the computer to understand what's going on.
Right.
So this is what the entire Y2K panic is predicated on, right? Mm-hmm. And the first person known to publicly address this issue was Bob Bemmer, who noticed it in 1958 as the result of work on genealogical software. Okay?
Okay.
He spent the next 20 years trying to make programmers, IBM, and the government of the United States and the International Organization for Standardization aware of this problem. And unfortunately, he caught very little attention. Unfortunately to him, I should say.
Right.
Nobody really seemed to care or to listen or catch on to this idea until about 1998. 1999 is when people started to be like, oh, maybe this would be a problem. Maybe
not humans putting off a problem until the very last minute.
Yeah. So that's around the time when it really started to pop off, I would say.
Right.
Y2K was thought to bring irreversible damage to many sectors of the economy. And it was even thought that Y2K could potentially set off nuclear weapons because of the time shift. Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, the computer magically thinking that it's 100 years ago instead of tomorrow, the computer might not know how to interpret that it is now 100 years ago, because computers like this didn't exist back in that time period, and neither right. did the nuclear codes are right. programmed to later years or whatever, right? So there was some genuine concern around that.
Right.
Other risks included banks, which calculate interest rates on a daily basis, and that presented a real problem. Interest rates are the amount of money that a lender, such as a bank, charges a customer, such as an individual or business loan. Instead of the interest rate for one day, the computer would calculate a rate of interest for minus almost 100 years.
I'll take that. Damn.
That would be a steal. You would be balling the next day. And what's the bank going to do? Say no?
I mean, yeah.
Centers of technology, such as power plants, were also threatened by the Y2K bug. Power plants depend on routine computer maintenance for safety checks, such as water pressure or radiation levels. Not having the correct date would throw off these calculations and possibly put nearby residents at risk. So, going back to what Kyle was just mentioning a little bit ago, you might be curious to hear this. In 1984, a woman who worked for an insurance company in Illinois entered into her computer an annuity date due in the early 2000s. Her computer interpreted that as a century earlier, and it churned out nonsense. So she inputs the year 2000 as a date in her computer, and as a result, the computer was not able to process what was happening and just like spat out random code or something.
Mm-hmm.
She and her husband then wrote a book titled Computers in Crisis: How to Avert the Coming Worldwide Computer Systems Collapse. A wonderful title, I might say.
You'll love a good book title here.
Not many people noticed this, however. Again, very similar to Bob Bemmer. Nobody was really listening to these people.
I mean, I would skip over that book at Barnes & Noble, for sure.
I think so, too, yeah. But by the end of the 1980s, people in the Social Security Administration were beginning to find that they, too, could not calculate figures for after the year 2000.
Uh-oh.
In 1994, Social Security started going through all its millions of lines of relevant computer code to try to fix the problem. The Defense Department ran into similar difficulties and began a similar project because they were now planning stuff so far in advance and the computers were not able to interpret this information as being in the future.
Right.
A senior defense official said at one point, quote,
"If we built houses the way we build software, the first woodpecker to come along would destroy civilization."
Ooh, that's pretty accurate based off what is going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty flimsy at this point, and people are starting to notice, and people are starting to freak out, and the government's starting to notice, and the government's starting to freak out.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation also depends on the correct time and the correct date. You know what I mean?
A little bit.
Airlines, in particular, were put at risk as computers with records of all scheduled flights would be threatened. After all, there were very few airline flights in the year 1900, right?
Right.
And if the computer is going to spit out nonsense because a flight is taking place in the year 2000... As we've talked about on this show before, like air traffic control is going to have a nightmare navigating
that's terrible.
Because the computer won't even be able to interpret what's going on, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
By the second half of the 1990s, concerns about the big coming clock change was even more rampant. Even Om Shinrikyo, that we've talked about on the show.
Yeah.
And their former leader, Shoko Asahara, believed that the world was going to end in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Asahara and his followers believed that the apocalypse came soon after the year 2000, and in order to survive Armageddon, Om Shinrikyo members must possess a special resistance to chemical and bacterial weapons. You can go listen to our episode on this. Kyle did an amazing job. We talk about this a little bit more in depth, right?
Mm-hmm.
The group's attack on it was a cool episode. The group's attack on the subway in Tokyo may have been one way of proving their invulnerability to these chemical agents, right?
Right.
The United States Congress dutifully began investigating the matter and failing to pass bills to do something about it. So people were getting concerned, and the bills to, like, do something were being struck down, right? In 1998, the United States government finally took action. President Bill Clinton literally addressed the Y2K issue, the Y2K bug, for those of you who do not know.
That's wild.
Our boy Bill signed an executive order creating a Council on Year 2000 Conversion. And he put in charge of this an OMB deputy director named John Kosinkin. Clinton told the United States during this time that, quote,
"In a business that approaches the new year armed with only a bottle of champagne and a noisemaker is likely to have a very big hangover New Year's morning."
That was such a bad Bill Clinton.
Oh my God. No, it was great. I loved it. I thought it was great. And I mean, essentially what he's saying there is just like, this might rock our socks a little bit, and we're looking into it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
By then, big business was not only stirring, but seriously investing in preventative measures. AT&T, in preparation for the implications that this could cause, ended up using $500 million a year in the late 90s trying to like do preventative maintenance for this.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm. And additionally, it's something that we haven't mentioned so far, is, and this is really important, Y2K was not only a software program, but Y2K was not only a software problem, it was also a hardware problem. All right. Software refers to the electronic programs used to tell the computer what to do, and the hardware is the type of machinery that the computer is using, right?
Right.
Software and hardware companies raced to fix the bug and provided Y2K compliant problems to help, right? Very similar to what we were just talking about with Halley's Comet. The market responded to the Y2K bug.
Right.
The simplest solution, kind of like Kyle was bringing up, was theorized to be the best solution. The date simply needed to be expanded to a four-digit number. That's what computers needed to interpret now.
Right.
Governments, especially in the United States and the United Kingdom, worked to address this problem. But again, the scale that we're talking about here is like, we're not only talking about, it's not only just like how many people and how many programs need this to change. It's the fact that every single piece of software and every single piece of hardware has only ever done a two-digit year. You know what I mean? And right. So that's inherently, that's why these things go hand in hand. That's why it's important to notate the software and the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular stretch of history, I guess you could say, blossomed into a golden age for IT people, survivalists, and especially end time Christians, like televangelists and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
A computer consultant named Peter De Jager made Y2K his specialty. And he became so well known, giving so many speeches and seminars, that the American Stock Exchange launched an index of the stocks of Y2K-related businesses and called it the De Jager Year 2000 Index. That's how much he was popping
off. Wild.
I know. The New York Times named him the Paul Revere for the year 2000 computer crisis. The British are coming. The British are coming. Y2K is coming. Y2K.
The four digits are coming. The four digits are coming.
Exactly. And amid all of this, you also pair this with, you know, some religious fanaticism as well. The year 2000 also marked the second millennium of the birth of Christ, right? According to the Christian religion. And the book of Revelation, which we have also brought up on this show a couple times, could be interpreted in such a way that a millennium meant the beginning of the end of time, right? And this did not go unnoticed. Jerry Falwell, a famous televangelist in this time period, proclaimed that, quote,
Y2K may be God's instrument to shake up this nation, to humble this nation, to start a revival that spreads over the face of the earth before the rapture of the church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy, Jerry Falwell, began taking orders for a video titled A Christian's Guide to the Millennium Bug and was selling them for $28 a copy. He also began storing up on food and ammo. Very, you know, very enlightening stuff coming from this guy.
Yeah.
Let me just say.
Seriously.
But it's not just any one particular group of people that was experiencing this like super heavy. A lot of people were kind of freaking out about this. Books with titles surrounding the crisis also proliferated. One such title is Y2K equals 666 ? Which is a pretty good one. I like that one. I appreciate that one. That one's pretty fire. There were also titles such as Spiritual Surviving During the Y2K Crisis, right? Okay. All just adding fuel onto this fire. Websites, which were common at the time, also sold. The websites that would sell ammo, supplies, and bulk food also skyrocketed in popularity. Kind of similar to what we talk about in 2012, where like when people think that the world is going to end, they like they freak out and they stock up, right?
Yeah. For sure.
In February of 1999, the United Nations set up an international Y2K cooperation center. They are arriving.
Might have missed the boat on that one, guys.
They are arriving so late to this party, dude. They're like, all right, it's February of the. We have 10 months to stop the world from ending. You know what I mean? And then in December of 1999, the United States and Russia opened a joint center for the year 2000 strategic stability to try to avert accidental missile launches or nuclear attacks.
In December of 99!
they were like, let's start working on the nuclear stuff.
You have less than 30 days to get this figured out. Make sure none of these nukes go off.
Yeah, we should probably start doing that in December. Meanwhile, for individual personal protection, a Massachusetts company marketed an $89 Y2K survival kit that included an abacus, a flashlight, and a compass. $89 for all that.
An abacus? Are you fucking kidding me? That's so funny, dude.
Dude, it's pretty funny.
Doesn't get you gotta count anything.
Now, what I'm about to tell you right here is kind of crazy, and this is real, and this actually happened. As the New Year's Eve drew nearer, the Federal Reserve of the United States of America ordered the printing of an extra $70 billion in paper money, about 255 extra dollars per person in the U.S., in case the banks failed and the banks' like money went away because the computer was like, oh no.
Jesus Christ.
The Chase Manhattan Bank set up 27 command centers to monitor its network around the clock.
Holy shit.
Citigroup opened a central command center in a location that they would not disclose. They kept it a secret for some reason. And then on December 31st, 1999, the clock finally struck midnight. The 0 hour came first in the South Pacific, right?
Right.
In New Zealand, as a philosophy professor named Dennis Dutton later wrote, quote,
Champagne and skyrockets were the only explosions of interest since telephones, ATMs, and cars, computers, and airplanes worked just fine.
Midnight after midnight came and went around the globe. In Australia, a machine that printed bus tickets got the date wrong. In Italy, some prison inmates briefly had their sentences extended by a century. In England, a tide gauge failed. In the US, a spy satellite ran on a backup system for a few hours. In Hong Kong, police breathalyzer equipment stopped working. Around the world, cash registers here and there spat out the date as 1900, leaving customers with receipts that they might want to keep as souvenirs, right?
Jeez.
All this to say, it was pretty uneventful. When the midnight hit all around the world, everyone was like, okay, all right, we're fine. Guess nothing catastrophic happened.
Keep paying taxes.
And it was like one of those things, like how I mentioned, like the prisoners got their sentences extended by a century. Like they were all like, okay, well, obviously. Like it's kind of like we forgot that like we're humans and we can make the executive decisions and we can interpret this data as like wrong.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, okay, well, this is wrong. You know what I mean?
Like, come on, guys.
Come on. Oh. In Slovenia, the uneventfulness of the Y2K was so anticlimactic that a top official in Slovenia was accused of exaggerating the danger, and he got fired from his position.
That's wild.
Because he hyped it up so much. All of this to say, we haven't really like learned yet. This was 24 years ago, approximately, at this point, right? 24 years ago. And we're going to have this problem again, I feel as though, right? It's like, even at the 10 intervals, you know, it's
chance,
like 2010, 2020, 2030, 2100, right? Which I won't be around to see. But like, maybe some of you folks listening will be around to see that. And I'm sure that there's going to be a similar phenomena that happens. People get anxious. They get freaked out by stuff like this. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that it'll be very similar stuff as to what happened in 2012 and Y2K and Halley's Comet and all of the things that we've been talking about so far, I would say. And that, my double-digit year intervals, was the story of Y2K.
Great job, Arden.
Yeah, thanks. I had to come up with that last part on the fly real quick.
That was good. My goodness. Oh, Y2K. What a topic. Jeez.
It is really a crazy story.
I think really you summed it up pretty perfectly right at the end there, by saying, you know, we kind of forgot that at the end of the day we're the humans and we get the executive decision. And like any of these miscalculations that were made, we could just be like, no.
Yep.
Like, I understand some of the panic around, like, you know, maybe weapons or like power plants exploding or stuff like that.
Right.
I guess I can understand some of that anxiety, but much beyond that, Y2K really just seems like it got extremely blown out of proportion to me.
And it did. And very similar to what you brought up in your section of tonight's episode with Halley's Comet, like, it really was a huge business opportunity. Like, people really, really capitalized on the anxiety and the fear that people were feeling.
There's always money to be made at the end of the world, for sure.
And I feel like that is something that was really demonstrated in both of our outlines. Again, not intentional, but...
Yeah. We didn't know what each other were covering until we sat down to record today. So
yeah, exactly. And so I agree with you. Like, it's the interpreting the data for me. I'm like, you can look at this piece of paper and be like, obviously this dude hasn't been in this jail since 1900. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like, you can look at, you know, Halley's Comet, for example, and be like, objectively, yeah, it's a little spooky that there's this comet coming, again, in the grand scheme of things, very close to the planet that puts off this poisonous gas. But, like, it is still so far from us.
It is.
Like.
Yeah.
No gases are going to be coming remotely close to our atmosphere, you know?
Exactly.
At least in a scale that makes sense to us, right? So, yeah.
And again, like, to illustrate what we were just talking about, you have a story that occurred in the year 1910, right? Which is what Kyle's outline was about. And then in Y2K, that this is literally, once again, 24 years ago, almost to the day that we're releasing this episode, right? And so to put that kind of like, the history repeats itself thing into perspective, like it happened twice in the same century for completely different reasons. And it happened multiple other times during that century too, by the way, all across the world in all different manners of, you know, hypothesizing about it. And so that's why we say we'll never run out of end of the world theories to talk about. I will say that in terms of a back assward stance, with Y2K, blown out of proportion, for sure. Halley's Comet, also blown out of proportion. And you did mention it in your outline. Like, a lot of people, although there was a lot of freaking out, a lot of other people were like, this is really cool, and we get to see this, and that's what I'm going to enjoy about this.
Exactly.
And that's what you should do in 2061, when Halley's Comet comes around again.
For sure. It's going to be so much fun. I'm definitely going to throw a party. I kind of got to agree with you. Both definitely blown out of proportion. And don't get me wrong, Halley's Comet is a 6 mile long comet. If it did smack into the Earth, that would not be good. That would be very bad.
Yes.
But it's not going to. We're okay.
Yep.
We're fine.
Exactly.
So just enjoy the pretty views, for sure. Well, thank you so much for listening to the podcast, everybody.
Thank you so very much. It is so fun to do episodes like this. I love it when me and Kyle get to share the episode. And so you could be doing anything with your time, and you're listening to us right now, right before 2024 starts, which we're excited for 2024, by the way.
Yeah, we are. It's going to be a big year. We got some big things in the pipe for you guys
And we're continuing. And we're going to be continuing JFK next week. And so we're already in the middle of something big. And so thank you very much for being here. It means the world.
You can subscribe and review if you're enjoying the show. And if you think someone else will enjoy the show, please share it with them.
Because word of mouth is the best way to spread that the Back Assards podcast has brought back yet another reoccurring series. I believe this is the second reoccurring series that we've brought back on the show, finally.
I think so, yeah.
You know. Now, the Back Assards podcast has your favorite reoccurring series, and that the Back Assards podcast is your favorite podcast.
You can listen to our previous episodes for more. I would recommend our episode on... And I would recommend our episode on the death of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you are listening to our JFK series, as a friendly reminder, if you haven't listened to Marilyn Monroe, it's kind of helpful. So go listen to that episode. It's a really good one. Kyle did a really good job.
Thank you. You can follow me and Arden on Twitter. I am at BackassWordKyle. Arden is at Arden_Smith. You can follow the podcast on all of your favorite social medias. On Twitter, at BackAssWordsPod. Instagram, BackAssWordsPod. TikTok, BackAssPod. Facebook, search the BackAssWords Podcast. And you can also subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/BackAssPod. I'm Kyle.
I'm Arden.
And we will see you guys next week. Unless the fucking world ends on on the strike of midnight. We'll see. But if not, we'll see you guys in the new year with even more JFK. And if we do see you in the next year, make sure that you get your tinfoil hats, because you know we're coming at you with some major conspiracies next week with JFK. So make sure that you come in with your tinfoil hats so you can stay safe.
And as you are preparing your tinfoil hats, just remember that as you're recording the date, as you are documenting this in your files, in your computer, that the proper way to store this data is with a two-digit year, and people are still doing that, and you should do it with them so that you can stay weird. The danger is real, my friend. Oh. Make sure you have accurate timekeeping, because that is important.
It's very important. We'll see you guys next week. It's important. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you.
See you guys. Stay safe out there.